Hello, you're listening to a podcast by Speak Up Radio, sharing some of the features and interviews we've done with inspiring people and organisations across London. Here, you'll get all the chat, insights and information, but you won't get any of the music, and that's because of how licensing works. To get the full experience, tune into the radio station 24/7 by visiting www.advocacyproject.org.uk/speakupradio. This work has been supported by Imperial Health Charity.
Hello and welcome to Speak Up Radio today. My name is Simon. I am a volunteer with the Drug and Alcohol Services in London, in the boroughs of Hammersmith and Fulham, and in Westminster, and in Kensington and Chelsea. And I'm here today with my co-presenter, Jude.
My name is Jude. Thank you very much for inviting me, Simon, to assist you today. I've actually been through the system of being a service user with Turning Point, who is a drug and alcohol service provider. Happy here today. Over to you.
Today we're going to be talking about the services available to families and carers of people who are working with or working through addiction. It's well known that there are plenty of services available to people who are in recovery, but less well known is that the services also look after their friends and their relatives. And those people, I can say we, because I've been through it myself, we also go through tough times. They benefit, as indeed did I, from support, which teaches us to look after ourselves, and in so doing we learn how to support the people who are themselves going through the recovery process. So this is something about which relatively little is known, but which is very, very valuable and important.
So firstly, we are joined by Zoe Ladbrook, who is the service manager for the inter alia, the Family and Carers Service in the for CGL in the boroughs of Westminster and Kensington and Chelsea. Zoe, hello. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi there, Simon. I'm very happy to join you today to tell you a bit about our service.
Thank you. Perhaps we could start. Who are our family and carer programs looking to help, and why is there a need to support them?
Well, in my opinion, family and carer programs set out to help anybody affected by someone else's substance use. Now, I work in an alcohol-only service, so forgive me if during this interview I refer to mainly alcohol, but the same rules apply to all substance, really. We help a variety of affected other people, and that includes spouses, siblings, parents, children, friends, you name it. This is why the range of support we offer is also very wide. We need to provide this support as addiction in families becomes a whole family problem. Families come to us with a wide range of needs, and affected others have usually been supporting their loved ones in so many ways already. I mean, the ways they support their others is like emotionally, socially, practically. Sometimes they have to advocate. Sometimes there's an awful lot of financial support. And they come to us when they're normally feeling absolutely exhausted after offering all this and feeling that they're getting nowhere. In that first meeting with, I call them clients, so it's an easy word for me to use. In our first meeting with our clients, we assess them and hear their story. We then discuss what help they need right now and work on that goal. The magic of being heard by someone who understands and sharing honestly with what it's been like is very freeing for people. Well, that's what they tell me. The feeling that they are no longer alone, and also the feeling that their guilty secret in some way has been sort of voiced. We try to focus on their needs and not the need of the drinker. And this is also something quite unique in a family's experience, because the whole focus has been on the person that's creating the chaos in the family, and the rest of the family always tend to have to fall into different roles and subservient or naughty or whatever, but the focus is always on the drinker. So it's really great for these people to suddenly have to focus on them, even though it's something they have to get used to because they're used to being the helper rather than the person that actually needs the help. A bit like that old saying, like, fit your own oxygen mask before you can help anybody else on a plane crash.
Yep. And could you just reiterate, what is typically the relationship of the people whom you are helping to the person who's struggling with the addictive behaviour?
Well, there's such a wide range of people that do come for help. I mean, we call it a family and carers service, and it's often called a family and friends service in other parts of the country, and that's absolutely fine. Because it's anybody that's affected by someone else's drinking. I mean, this could easily be your husband, your wife, or your daughter, or your child, or your brother, or your auntie, or your uncle, or really good friends, distant friends. Sometimes the person we end up helping is somebody not so close to the drinker because the drinker's lost all their family and friends. They've got nobody left to help them. So it really is a wide range, which is often the reason why there's so many different paths we go down to help. The only thing we don't do, which is a shame in our boroughs, is we don't have a young people's service. So we tend to refer out to other services if someone's under the age of 18.
I see. Thank you. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what support is available for the people whom you help.
Well, we provide one-to-one support, which is 6 sessions, and then we review after the 6 sessions, and if somebody needs more support, we discuss it, and if we have the capacity, we will offer them more support. Now, a one-to-one session tends to be a listening, talking, advice and information, a little bit counsel-y, but we're not counselling, if that makes sense. So it's the one-to-one, it's a time for the person you're working with, the client, to let you know how they're feeling, what they need in, problems that have come up for them, problem solving and supporting. Apart from one-to-ones, we also offer workshops. Workshops in the olden days, before COVID, used to be done in groups face-to-face. But now, more and more, we tend to be doing the workshop ones as a one-to-one over virtuals. But the workshops are far more toolboxy. They're very useful and they're very practical. And it also strips some of the emotion away of what people are feeling. So a workshop can be how to communicate with somebody that's drinking, how not to bother communicating when somebody is absolutely drunk. We have another workshop in how to set boundaries. Boundaries and trust are a very close-knit couple. So if you learn to set boundaries and you learn to do it in agreement with the drinking partner, this can really help with trust. We also do a workshop on just basic alcohol awareness because we get carers and loved ones trying to manage their drinker's alcohol. And of course, this can be quite dangerous because, as we know, it's an addiction, a physical addiction. So, you know, you need to be very careful with cutting down on alcohol. So we do sessions on that as well. We also do mild sessions on anxiety and depression for the carer. You know, they're not highbrow things. You know, they're things that you can probably find on an NHS website. So, but it just helps. It helps people to manage stuff while they're going through this awful time, you know, with their loved one. Now, apart from that, what we offer, that's me and my practitioner and my volunteers, we also have access to groups, which is, we have a fantastic smart group, which is started off to CGL alcohol users, and now it's for anybody. We also have a fantastic DOORS group, which is Drug and Alcohol Wellbeing Service, which is a substance use group, but we send people there as well because, you know, in our opinion, groups are valid and it really brings people into a sense of community. And we also have access to ETE and wellbeing, which is the same as anybody that's in our service for a drinking problem has. And then we also have access to our counselling service, and we can offer 12 weeks of counselling, which is slightly different from the drinker. They get offered 24 weeks, but we're very happy to be able to offer any counselling with a specialist who kind of knows about alcohol. So we're very lucky in our boroughs to have such a wide selection of different services we offer.
And I myself have benefited from the counselling, and I it is extraordinarily beneficial, and we are indeed lucky to have it, and I am highly appreciative. What would you say is the single most important underlying theme of the support provided to family and carers?
It's kind of quite a tricky thing for me to actually answer, because it's very difficult to define the most important theme, as everybody has their own kind of unique story and at different stages in their journeys. So, I mean, we're lucky. One of the reasons why our work's important, and we're lucky to have funding in place so we can provide more of a tailor-made approach. But I suppose what it comes down to is just kind of letting people understand that it's not their fault. The shame is not their shame. It's something that's more common than anybody ever knows. They can get help. And we try to help them with what small goal they actually want help with, rather than saying what we suggest is, you know, we ask our clients, what do you want help with? Often to start off with, they say, I want to help my loved one stop drinking. We will try that. We will say, of course, we try and help you to do that, because in the end goal, that will make you happy. Our journey often goes in twists and turns, and in the end, they haven't actually helped their drinker stop drinking, but they have learned to accept the life they're leading, or accept they want to change the life that they're living, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the most important message that was communicated to me was, I think, what Al-Anon calls the three C's. You didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you won't cure it.
Yeah, I do agree with the three C's, but the way we work is we find out what the person actually wants help with first, and then help them with that. And the three C's, of course, comes into it as well. But it isn't our first line of defence. Our first line of defence is, what do you want me to help you with? Let me hear you. I've really heard you. I've really listened.
Thank you. Jude, I think you had some questions.
Yes, I do. Hello, Zoe. Lovely to meet you.
Hi, Jude.
Hi. Thank you so much for all of that information. I'm sure some of our listeners would be able to relate to what you've said and hopefully move forward in coming forward for support. I myself had gone through a certain situation where literally my daughter picked me up off the floor. And while she was supporting me, I actually wondered what support she was having, mm-hmm. As she had a baby of two and another one on the way. So thank you for all you've said, and hope you don't mind, I've got a couple of questions myself. How does the support tend to change people's attitude and behaviour in the medium term?
I think it helps once person relaxes and realises they're not an expert and they've always done their best, and their best is sometimes good enough, sometimes not. But once somebody relaxes into that, I think it changes their attitude, as in, you know, I can only do my best. I can only make myself feel better. I cannot always make my loved one feel better. I cannot always make my loved one recover. But I can, if I want to stay on that journey with them, I can, because now I know my limitations and I know I need to protect myself. It's quite amazing when people, you know, when you give people permission to let go of the reins, to stop having to, you know, manage, micromanage, feel they need to hide the fact that they've got a drinker in the household, you know, make excuses for them. We call it enabling people. You know, a lot of our carers don't realise that they're enabling. And, you know, you have to point it out to them in kind of subtle ways, because you don't want to be told, well, you've been doing it wrong all along, haven't you? Really, you know, that's the last thing. You want to sort of make people feel embarrassed for asking for help. But I think on generally, it's in the medium and long term, people can relax into the role they are in. You know, they are still a mother or a wife or a child. They don't have to become a doctor. They don't have to become an expert. They just have to be there and support their drinker if they want to, and also support themselves, which is the most important thing. Because if you're drinking and it's at the bottom of where you're going to be, you know, it doesn't help you to have somebody saying, stop drinking, if you love me, you'd stop drinking. It helps to have somebody who's there with you, but not totally mollycoddling you, if you get what I mean.
No, I totally understand. I kind of get what you're saying about asking for permission, because there's obviously a stigma around all of these sort of things, and an embarrassment possibly as well. And to underline, you know, you're not going to be the expert, you know, and you do need the support. And it's amazing how many people you might think is looking normal out there actually do need the support. So hopefully that gets through to people. But lastly, before I ask you for your, we've got some music coming up and you're going to make your own choices and why you've chosen them. But the last question, sort of, how do people access support, and is it available nationally?
That's interesting too, because it is available nationally. The way locally we access support, the best way I would suggest to anybody listening that needs to access support would be to go to their local drug and alcohol service, because they've all got websites. If you just Google local drug and alcohol, you will be sent through to the right people. People that work with substance use will be able to advise you the best place to go. Most services now nationwide have some sort of family and carers section. Sadly, it's a little bit of a postcode lottery still, because it all depends on how much funding different authorities can provide for drug and alcohol services. But that would definitely be my first point of call. If you want some structured help, then the drug and alcohol service. You can also go on to mutual aid websites. I mean, AA do Al-Anon and SMART do Family and Friends. So there's different types of support you can get. But nationally, I mean, there's a lot of campaigning going on in Parliament at the moment. It got thrown out not long ago, and they've had to start again with funding for children of alcoholics. But the funding is a crucial thing. Every borough and county in England tries their best to support families of substance users, but it really does depend on who's holding the purse strings. Some boroughs in London will be lucky like us and have money to pay for a practitioner and pay for a manager. Lots of our services are managed by drug teams, so the carers, it's almost like an add-on, which in my opinion doesn't help, because it still makes that carer feel like they're not very important. You know, you're the add-on, you're there because, rather than you're there because you need the help. But it is what it is, and I think every borough tries really, really hard, no matter how much. If they've got a lot of money, like, you know, lucky old by borough, or very little like some of the other boroughs we work in, but every borough seems to have at least a group, and the group work is invaluable too. So yeah, that's kind of where I am with that.
Within the by-borough, just to be clear, it's not necessary for somebody to be registered with the recovery services in order for the family and friends to access help.
No, I mean, we have some sort of rules and regulations that we have to follow, but we're kind of quite loose with them. We say you have to have either your drinker, for want of a better word, has to be a resident of the two boroughs, or the carer has to be a resident of the two boroughs. So a carer can come to the alcohol service and say, you know, my son's drinking to oblivion, he's got no interest in getting help, but I'd like some help. And we will say, yes, we will help you. We will encourage the son, if he wants help, he can get help too. But as long as either the drinker or the carer is in the borough, we can help them. If we get somebody from outside the borough contact us and they have no connections with our borough, then we will give them advice and guidance in a one-off session and refer them to their own authority to try and get some help.
Thank you.
Brilliant, thank you. I mean, I don't know if I can ask an additional question. I don't know how long have you been in your work, but statistically, has it risen highly in the last 10 years in the sense of people coming to you?
Yeah, I mean, I've been running this service, I don't know, about 3 or 4 years now. Mm-hmm. I think about 3 years now. And before that, I was working the alcohol service, and I've been in substance use for about 15 years in all different genres. But we tend to get, if I'm thinking of the alcohol caseload, we tend to get 1 in 10 of an alcohol client will offer the service to one of their loved ones. Because often we get people referring because the practitioner working with the drinker will have the drinker's mother ringing up and saying, what can you do? And then having to manage two different scenarios. So then the perfect solution is they can hand the mother onto our service so we can keep them separate so it's not all entangled. But yeah, I've forgotten the rest of your question.
No, I mean, it relates to, because I kind of think because of the pandemic and what we've all been through and so-called, what I kind of see sometimes what we think is normal people, but I know behind closed doors, there's problems. And I just hope and pray that the government does fund people like you and establishments like you, because it is well needed and people do need to come forward and voice their opinion on that. But thank you so much, Zoe. I don't know if you want to add anything there, Simon.
No, just to ask Zoe for a choice of a piece of music and what inspires her choice.
Well, this is almost the most tricky thing of the whole interview because, you know your own subject, but you think music. So I've gone for Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper, Hello, from the fabulous movie.
Oh, yes.
And... you know, it's A Star Is Born. It's a story of a rock star and a pop princess. But it's also a story of loving an alcoholic, loving the highs, being miserable and sad in the lows. And, yeah, I mean, it's also a bit of a banging tune. So, you know, that's kind of why I chose that one.
So thank you very, very much for your time today. Greatly appreciated.
Brilliant. Thank you. Cheers, Zoe.
Tell me something, girl.
Well, that was Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper from their version of the film A Star Is Born. And next up, we have John Taylor from the Family and Carers Service at Turning Point, who's going to tell us about the part that groups play in helping those affected by other people's addictions. Welcome, John.
Hello, Simon. Good to be here. Thanks.
So tell us, why are groups so helpful to families and carers?
I think therapy in general. I mean, my background is sort of first just to work in rehab, and I think isolation is a main thing about addiction, isolation and shame. And I think if you can put people, the shame and the isolation seems to be even more so with families. And if you can put people in a group with other people just for that identification, it can just take away the stigma, the shame and the isolation. And people realise that they're not alone with all of this and people will open up more. So I think that's the main thing why groups are so beneficial.
Does the stigma and the isolation that you describe, can that get in the way of people coming to groups?
Yeah, my experience is that a lot of people won't come in because I think it's quite, I think with addiction, it's kind of like a family secret. And people will actually say to me, oh, no, I can't come in and share with strangers. And what's happened to me for years and years and years, because you're telling your family secrets to strangers and people you've never met before. So, yeah, it can definitely be a barrier. The thing is, if you can get people into one group and realise, you know, that how the honesty and what you've got in that group, it can just break that. But sometimes it's about getting people in there, first of all. Yeah.
And once they get in there, quite often they presumably they discover that actually that's the group you can share with.
100%. And also, you know, they people, what I often hear is that people will say, I'm sharing stuff with these strangers, if you like, stuff that I've never shared with anyone else, stuff that I've never shared with family members, stuff that I've kept in, you know, since childhood or since, you know, a long, long time. So, yeah, once we can get people in, it just breaks that sort of stigma. Yeah.
What are the emotions that people typically express when they first come to meetings?
I think it can be, you know, lots of emotion. I think the first ones we've said there is about the shame, the isolation, the anger, you know, the anger at the addiction, the anger at the person, the anger at themselves. I think it's always negative emotions when people come in, because people will not come in. People will not come and get help if they're feeling positive emotions. It's always got to be on the negative. So I would definitely say, you know, resentments, you know, self-blame, isolation, stigma, anger, and powerlessness. That's the one that they might not realise, that they actually are powerless over someone else's addiction. So that's the kind of like the one that people realize maybe the most when they come into group.
And you mentioned also isolation, loneliness. I mean, the feeling of being with somebody who is physically present but emotionally absent.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, emotionally absent, but also to take it a little bit further, like this sort of powerlessness thing and how this can affect people. You're watching someone who's very unwell. You might have feelings, which is very common, and every one of my family member feelings that this person could die. You know, feelings that this person is really, really unwell and there's nothing I can do about it. You know, you mentioned there about not being present, you know, then you go on to other levels of sort of like stages of loss. You know, you've lost this relationship. You've lost this person, the way this person used to be. So it can be on so many levels. And even when people have been to groups for a little while, you know, they can still come in with them feelings, you know, them things might trigger them. I still have them feelings. No, it's not.
Could you restart, you know, that one? Restart that bit. Could you go back to the beginning of that sentence? That the line cut out.
Okay. Yeah. What one? Just start the question again.
No, just go back about a paragraph.
Yeah, and it's. When people come in, you know, that sort of thing about, you know, the family members, it's not just that sort of thing about not being emotionally present. It's that thing about how really bad things might happen to the family member. I mean, I have every family member who you know, can have feelings that their loved one might pass away, you know, and there's nothing they can do about it. They're watching their loved one really unwell. And there's nothing they can do about it. So, yeah, them sort of feelings. And also the feelings can come up a lot, even when people have been in the groups for a little while. You know, addiction is an ongoing thing, and family members are humans, and feelings come and go.
So people, if people manage to overcome the difficulties in coming to a group, they come and they express these emotions to begin with. What typically is their reaction when they first start to share, and when they first realize that they're in a safe place? What how do they react?
I think the thing that they get with any sort of therapy or any sort of thing is kind of like hope, hope that they're not alone, hope that identification that they're not the only person who feels like this. They're not the only person who is going on for them. They're not the only person in the world, because I know that family members, when they're in the sort of madness of addiction, you know, they can really feel they're the only person who goes on, you know, that this is going on for them. I kind of like, it's almost like the lights come on for them, and they get some hope back, really, I think. And that's what it's about. It's about trying to give people hope and, you know, whatever way, faith, hope, you know, whatever way you want to look at it, just that, you know, they're not alone in all of this.
Yes, and that feeling that, while all the stories are individual, the common threads, very few of them are different. The common threads that run through them are very strong indeed.
Yeah, I mean, 100%, and I always say this, every substance misuses, you know, story is different. You know, people use differently, they're using different drugs. Some people might, you know, be going down, you know, the criminality. Some people might not. Some people might be on benders. But what is, you're so right, what's the common feeling is the feelings that the families have. You know, that is the sort of common thing, the feelings that families have. And I always say, when you talk about feelings, I always say to my clients, you know, we can't take away your feelings here, you know, but what we can make you realize that you're not the only one who has these feelings, and you're not the only one, you know, who is dealing with this.
Quite, because the isolation makes one feel that your position is uniquely awful, and it may be awful, but it's not, you're not alone.
And I think that, you know, the proof is in the pudding, Simon, that why people keep coming back, you know, week after week, you know, so they can get that, however long the group is, 90 minutes an hour, they can get that hour that you're not alone. And as you know, I always try and make the group about the family member, not about the substance misuser, because for the, I don't know how many hours there are in a week, take away
168,
take away 1.5, probably for the rest of them. So 68, that
166 and a half.
Okay, 166 and a half is about the substance misuser. So that 90 minutes that we have in our group, I make it about the family member, you know, definitely. And that's why people keep coming back.
Okay. So what are the main messages that participants get from meetings?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we use a lot of like, we use a program, the 5-step family program, you know, which is about looking at the harms and how this physically and mentally affects its had on you. You know, we use, I think originally come from Al-Anon, like the 3 C's, which is a great, great mantra. You know, you didn't cause it, you can't.
Could you just tell people who Al-Anon are?
Yeah, sure. So Al-Anon, it's funny, no one's ever heard of Al-Anon. So everyone's heard of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. But Al-Anon is the family group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Families Anonymous is the family group of Narcotics Anonymous. And your group, Smart Families is the family group of smart recovery. And it's interesting. No one's ever heard of the family groups, but everyone's heard of the sort of, you know, the substance misuse groups. And that still goes on today.
There's no question. The family and friends, family and carer side is still slightly the Cinderella part of the service.
Oh, 100%. I still go around to do meetings, you know, for the 10 years I've been doing this job, and there's still people who say, oh, I knew there was support for substance misusers. I didn't know there was support for the family members. And that still goes on today, you know, from clinical leads to on the ground. You know,
my apologies. I dragged you away from, you were about to tell us about the three C's of Al-Anon.
Yeah, we come back. So the three C's, which is a great, great mantra. You know, you didn't cause it, you can't cure it, and you won't control it.
That's important enough. Say it again.
Yeah, you didn't cause it, you can't control it, or you won't, and you won't cure it. I think the good thing is that. Why that's so good, a lot of family members will come in with guilt, a lot of guilt. And sometimes it's got to be said, a lot of the times this guilt can be driven by the substance misuser's manipulation, you know, and put it on them. That's quite a common thread, because unfortunately with addiction, you know, substance misusers will do anything to get what they need. And they do put a lot of, especially parents, they will put a lot of guilt on the parents. So that mantra is so, so important. And like I always say, it's that back to that palace. There's nothing any of us can do to stop someone drinking or using drugs. It's got to come from them, an inside job. So them three C's, you know, especially you didn't cause it, you know, I think they're so important.
And I think the other thing is trying to explain to people that it's okay to look after themselves. Self-care does not represent disloyalty to your loved one or abandonment of their cause. But you can only support them to the extent that you are strong yourself.
And it's really interesting. You've probably seen me like do this, and family members always being really selfish. Like when they're putting down boundaries, because they've been conditioned for so long to think, you know, to look after the substance misuser. And I cross out the sort of ISH and put care. You're not being selfish. You're showing self-care. And that is a big driver all the time. Self-care. You know, what are you doing to look after yourself? Because it's quite alien, especially when people come into my group at first. They want to talk about substance misuser all the time. What about them? And I say, listen, you know, this group is not about them. This is about you. What are you doing for yourself? And I think that is definitely the main thread. Yeah, this is about you, not about them.
And how easy is it to persuade people that they can't fix somebody else's problem?
I think it's different for everyone, Simon. I think, you know, there's people in the groups who have been there for years. It said it took them, you know, 2 years to actually finally realise. For some people, they get it quickly. I mean, the common thread, and we do it in group, is that I'd say to people, when I say to them, look, there's nothing you can do around their substance misuser, they would look at me and say, you're mad, you know. And I think, well, I might be mad, but I definitely, you know with my experience, there's nothing any of us can do. So I think it's different. People get it at different times, but that's okay. You know, as long as you keep coming back to the group, that's okay. You know, if you still think you can try, the thing around that question, though, is a lot of people won't come into the group or won't engage in the family service because what I'm saying, because that's been their role for years and years and years, you know, to try and fix them or try and look after them. And when I'm saying that, you know, they're not interested. So yeah, I think it can be, you know, different. Everyone's different and people get it at different times.
And tell us about how the meetings are actually run. Is it an interactive discussion between the participants or at meetings, or do meetings vary in their format?
So so we normally have a check-in with the groups, and then we'll see if there's any themes coming up. I mean, we loosely run to a five-step family program. So normally one of the themes from the five steps will come up. You know, ways of responding, self-care, support networks. And then we'll just, you know, the unfortunate thing with the online, you know, a little bit of the interaction has gone. I mean, when you're in an actual room with people, you know, you can open it up more. But it is just a space of whatever anyone comes up. And the main thing, I think, is this sort of thing about identification. Anyone identify, you know, someone might have their little bit of whatever they're saying. Anyone identify with what they're saying. I think to try and the interaction about identification, I think that's the main theme that I try and keep going.
Yes, I think the other thing that I sometimes find is that when one is seeking to deliver a message which is slightly counterintuitive, particularly around the "there's nothing you can do to fix this," it's one thing for them to hear it from a facilitator. If they hear it from another group member, quite often, they hear from another group member how that has changed their attitude and their outlook on life, it can sound more convincing if it comes from a peer as opposed to, you know, from a professional or from just somebody, even the role of a facilitator.
Yeah, no, I don't know if I mentioned that. I'm happy you reminded me. I don't know if I mentioned it at the beginning. When I get the assessment, Simon, I say to people, look, you can come and have the one-to-ones with me, but you're going to get so much more out of being in groups with other people. You know, you are just like what you said. You know, you're going to get the identification from the other people. And I think there's still, you know, there will be a barrier. Sometimes people are looking for barriers. I'm a professional. You know, I'm paid to say this. Of course I am. I'm working to a program. But when you're in a group with other family members, they're not paid to say this. They're just telling their truth. So I think what you talk about there, the barriers can break down. There's nothing you can say, you know, that what these people are saying is the truth. And yeah, you will get recovery for families so much quicker, definitely.
And for how long do people typically come to meetings? And you know, how in the longer term, how do these meetings change their attitudes and behaviours?
So when I took this job on many, many years ago, so the meetings are ongoing for family members. You know, they can stay as long as they're engaging. You know, they can stay as long as they like. And we've had people there who have been there for years and years and years. I mean, they just keep coming back because some of them, it's their choice. They still live with the alcoholic, or they still live with the addict, or they're still in their life. And they just find that, you know, they come to the group to sort of maybe recharge on their boundaries, to hear things, and just to keep their own sort of recovery, as I was saying. I think the change in people always change. I mean, it's great seeing people's changes. We've got people who have become peer mentors. One of our peer mentors, she left years ago because she didn't like what the group was saying, and she'll tell this story, and she left for 6 months, and then she was left isolated just with her and her son, the addict, and it got really bad, really dark, because she didn't have that space. And she came back and then trained as a peer mentor, So, yeah, we've got people who are staying in, you know, for years and years and years. And some people have not had meetings for 2 years because they don't like the Zoom thing or they haven't got an email. So they hopefully will be getting back soon into that sort of interaction, Simon.
And I think it's also helpful for people in the early stages of the process to hear from others who've been through it and been helped through it, and to see that there is another side, or you know, you can, there is a far side to get to.
Yeah, no. People are in different stages. I think that's sort of, you know, that's why it keeps growing. You get people who've been here for eight, and then a newcomer coming in. Oh, you've been here. And also, the great thing is, say someone's a newcomer coming in, but someone's been there for 5 years. But they've been there for 5 years, but they're still sharing about the problems they're having and how they deal with it. I think that just gives strength, you know, of the sort of what the group's given them. Why are you still coming back after years and years and years? Because this is my, like what we said at the beginning, this is my safe space, you know, where I can share with these people what's going on for me and not feel judged and be given a space. And I think that's what recovery is. Everyone is in different stages of recovery. And I think that's why groups work so well.
John, thank you very much for everything you've told us. Finally, could you pick a piece of music for us and explain the reason for your choice?
So as it's families group, so I always pick this one. I was asked to do a radio. So my song is Someone Like You by Adele. And the reason I'm picking that is because I remember when that was out about 10 or 11 years ago, I remember my daughter in a school play, she sung that. And every time I hear it, I just want to, well, cry, really. And it just takes me back to, when we're talking about family, it just takes me back to my daughters when they were young and lovely. And then when they went into the teenage years, it all goes wrong. But that's another story. But it just takes me back to my girls when they were really young and their young childhood and my daughter singing that. So, yeah, that would be my song.
John Taylor, thank you very much indeed.
Brilliant. Thanks, Simon. Pleasure.
So, our last guests today are Nick and Kate, who have been coming to a weekly SMART family and friends meeting, the one that I facilitate for, how long is it now?
I think it was last August that we started.
5 months.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Okay. Well, you're very good to talk to you today. Welcome. And perhaps you can start by telling us what brought you to the group.
Yeah, well, what brought us to the group really was desperation, because we'd run out of other options to try and solve the seemingly irreconcilable nightmare of having two teenage daughters, now actually in their mid-20s, who had mental health problems, but also had serious addiction issues with drugs and alcohol. And after about 8 years of rehab and so many other programs that we tried to get them to engage in, we suddenly realized that we were really struggling personally as well. And that the two of us needed to get some kind of help from outside. And that's really where it started.
Thank you. And how did you learn about this particular group, and how did you originally feel about attending?
Well, we were talking, and I think this is one of the interesting things that happened during those years, those nightmare, horrific years. We started to open up and talk more to people when they asked us, you know, do you have children? You meet new people. Do you have children? And so we actually just were talking to someone that's been a part of your group for some time. Her son has drug addiction problems, and she was very understanding of our predicament and suggested that we could try out your group and gave us the contact details, having spoken to you. And I have to say, I was very keen to have a go at this because I had tried some years ago another organisation to join a family and friends meeting, and it just didn't work for me. And I know every group's going to be different and different ones will work differently for different people. But I was very keen to try this. Nick was not quite so sure about that, but I just said to him, look, why don't I log on, join the group? You can hover in the background and listen. And if you like what you're hearing, you can maybe join, but you don't have to, you know, because I think it's one of those things you've got to feel you want to do it. And he hovered in the background for about 5 minutes and began to really kind of feel that it resonated. And so he joined at the same time.
I did.
And then he became, I would say, probably the most committed, having found it so helpful.
I am a convert for sure. Because when we got into the meetings, we suddenly realized how much we needed that outside contact so that we could share our issues with like-minded people.
Could you talk a little, though, about why you were initially reluctant? I mean, you know, you're not alone in finding the initial approach difficult. And what was it for you that made you take some convincing?
It's an interesting question. You know, as kind of seemingly intelligent adults, you would think when you've got a problem that you can't fix, that you go and ask other people, experts, to see if they can help you. But somehow with this terribly painful family issue of having two daughters that we love very much, seeing them struggle so much, but also realizing that we were being pulled into a mire as well by their issues, and it wasn't helping us at all. We weren't sleeping. We really struggled to socialize sometimes because with our friends, you know, the first thing they'd say, oh, how are the girls? And you think, oh no, that's the last thing I want to talk about on a night out. But that's true. And they're only being friends and being kind. So we suddenly realized that it was affecting our ability to socialize, to talk with our friends, to sleep. And there were kind of mental health issues that we had to address. So we knew we needed to do something. And Smart Recovery had been recommended to us, and we just knew that we had to do something. And so we gave it a shot.
Did you think you were reticent because you didn't want to open up to a group, do you think?
Probably so, yeah. But I think there's also a little bit of, I don't want to talk about this anymore.
Okay.
I think about it all the time. I lie awake at night thinking about it all the time. The last thing I want to do in my conscious hours is to talk to somebody about it. But actually, that is absolutely wrong, because that's the first thing you need to do, is to talk to people outside of a group and share their wise counsel and their thoughts and their views. And it's been hugely, hugely beneficial to us.
I would say it's been life transforming, and that's not, you know, that's really not overplaying it. It has literally transformed our lives to be part of a group who are so caring, genuine. You feel very safe. You feel that you can trust people to talk about things. And I think we've shared things sometimes in meetings we thought, whoa, you know, we wouldn't normally kind of talk about those sorts of things with other people. And that safe place where people understand what's going on and can offer advice that actually is incredibly helpful has been enormous in the way that we are now able to start living our lives again.
And I think we don't feel like we're being judged either in those meetings. That's a wonderful thing, I think, because there's no doubt about it, I think, for parents and people and friends who are in this situation where they have friends or family in recovery, there's this kind of sense of, what did I do wrong? What have we done wrong? Why has this happened? And the truth is, those are unhelpful emotions. And the group, I think, managed to tease out of us that we haven't caused, I know it's the cliche, we haven't caused this, we can't control it, we can't cure it. But through this group, we can find ideas and strategies that might help us, and in that way might help our loved ones.
So what would you say are the most important things that you've taken from the group, and you know, how have they changed your behaviours?
Gosh, I mean, I think in the early stages, we were very angry and very upset with all that we were dealing with, because it was very, very painful. We could see our girls were in pain, but we were also in pain, and that anger was not a helpful emotion at all. And I absolutely, we are not, I really feel just we're not angry like we were, which is really good, because you can deal with things much better when you're not angry. And we also don't blame ourselves anymore, because we used to keep thinking, what have we done wrong? And we realise now, you know, we can't blame ourselves. It isn't our fault. We can't change our daughter's behaviour. That's another really important lesson. But we can support them and love them, but we can't actually change what they're doing. So those are some of the things that I feel that we've learned. I'm sure you've learned.
Knowing the pain and the suffering that they are going through, it almost felt selfish to be focusing on ourselves and trying to look after ourselves. But it's very clear that the power and the wisdom of the group made us realize that we're not being selfish, and that self-care, looking after ourselves, was absolutely one of the key building blocks for us to be in a position to help them further in the future. So we don't feel like we're being selfish looking after ourselves. And indeed, we still spend a lot of time helping and looking after them, but we're also spending a good amount of time looking after ourselves as well.
And I think the kind of help that we're able to give them now, because one of the things we have really learned is a lot of the help that we were giving them actually wasn't helping them. In fact, it was probably making them get worse, because we were doing an awful lot of things that, you know, we know now, like giving them money. If they said they didn't have any money for food, well, that would just go straight on drugs or booze. You know, we've had to learn all those things, and it's taken us a long time to learn it. But it's been really important for us to learn how we can help them, how we can support them. You know, when you love people dearly, you want to do everything, but actually sometimes you have got to stand back, and that's the hardest thing, certainly as a parent, to stand back to actually let them make some of these choices.
I was going to ask you, you said that one of the things that led you initially to feel that you wanted to reach out for support was that you just discovered you couldn't fix it. And then the first thing you hear when you attend a group is, you can't fix it.
Yeah.
How is that to hear the first time?
It's a strange thing to hear, because you don't want to hear it. You want to believe that you have the capability to fix this problem if you keep sticking at it. And the truth is, I think we realize that we don't, because the only people who can fix these problems are the person that's in recovery themselves. But we can facilitate, we can help, we can support in constructive ways. And I think, you know, the wisdom and kindness of the group has allowed us to think that way.
Thank you. So finally, what would you say to anyone who might be looking for support but is reluctant, reticent about joining a group?
Well, I would say firstly, you have got absolutely nothing to lose by trying one out, really. And I wish that we'd found out certainly about Smart Recovery many years ago, because that's the other thing I would say is, if you can get involved before you've suffered year after year after year of this, partly because it would help, you know, yourself, but also you'll help your loved one. And so I would try and join as quickly as possible. I'd get in and, you know, and take a few sessions to really make up your mind about whether or not it's right. One session might not be quite enough. And just really give it a go, but be open to it. Be open and just see how it feels.
And I suppose the suggestion I would add to that is that not all groups are the same. So if the first group you try doesn't work for you, then that doesn't mean that groups are wrong. It just means that.
Absolutely. And I would also say, don't underestimate the power that you feel from having that. It's like a comfort blanket sometimes around you. It's an incredibly powerful thing, having other people sharing similar problems or talking about that and helping each other. And it's an extraordinary, I can't even quite explain why it is so powerful, but it is extraordinarily powerful.
I think also one of the wonderful things about the group is after you've been there for a few weeks, you kind of build confidence and you suddenly realize that you can contribute support and offer thoughts to people who are going through things that you've been through. So, and there's an enormous amount of comfort. Well, it's a nice thing to be able to sort or to help other people. Mm. And I think with the insights that we all have through the experiences that we've gone through, sometimes those insights are incredibly valuable to the other members of the group.
And we always appreciate it when there are people who are coming through to the later stages of their recovery, and they can tell stories to people who are just starting and give hope. So I agree with you. It is very, very beneficial. Thank you. Could I ask you? Would one or both of you like to pick a piece of music and tell us the reasons for your choice?
Gosh, well, I love lots and lots of different kinds of music, and we go and see lots of concerts, and the piece of music that I would choose is one that. It's the words, I guess, that mean a lot, because they're words that I used to play the song to one of my daughters, because addiction is a very challenging thing, and I couldn't understand why my daughter didn't have the inner strength to just give it a go and try all these support groups around her. And there's a record. I'm not a fan of the genre, but it's an R&B a female artist called Desiree, and the song is called "You've Got to Be." You've got to be strong. You've got to be tough. You've got to hang in there. And then the chorus part is that love will save the day. And I also think that. That is important, not just for your relationship with the person in recovery, but also the person you're doing it with. The fact that actually, I mean, Kate and I, thankfully, have always had a great, close relationship, but this has brought us closer together. And I think the lyrics of that song kind of articulate that if you have a strong love, it's enormously easier to get through all this stuff.
Okay, thank you very much indeed.
Yes, that's really lovely. So mine's quite different from that, and it's Louis Armstrong's Wonderful World, partly because it was a great favourite of my parents, and actually we played it at both their funerals, didn't we? Mm-hmm. But partly also because for many years when we were going through this horror of living with the chaos, the destruction, the violence, the everything that's horrible about addiction, it kind of felt as though our lives were like a thick fog, and it was hard to see the blue sky. Get up in the morning and think, oh God, it's another day, got to get through it, but you just keep on going. And now I can listen to that song and actually really realize that now. And I would say, again, thanks to Smart Recovery and the wonderful support we've got, that I actually do go out literally and see the skies of blue, the trees of green, and all the other things that he sings about in that lovely song. And that, even though the world is a horrible place at the moment with horrible things that are going on in the world, it is such a lovely thing to be able to connect with nature and to see the beauty that's around you. So that's why I would choose that song.
Thank you very much for that. And thank you both very much indeed for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
You're very welcome.
That was Louis Armstrong's Wonderful World, which is a great piece on which to finish. So, thank you. I hope this program's been informative to you all. Jude, thank you very much indeed for your help here today.
Thank you very much for inviting me. A lot of the stuff that was said I can relate to, so I hope it does to listeners as well.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks to all of you for listening, and have a wonderful day.
Brilliant.
Thank you for listening to our podcast today. If you'd like to leave us any feedback, you can email us at speakup@advocacyproject.org.uk, or you can go to our website, advocacyproject.org.uk/speakupradio. That's all one word. Thanks so much for listening, and do let us know what you thought.